I'm going to introduce Robert Shetterly, who's going to introduce Derek Jensen. Rob's a Maine painter and activist, and his paintings and prints are in collections all over the U.S. and Europe. He began to paint his portraits of Americans who tell the truth after the events of 9/11 and the subsequent response of the United States. In his words, "I began painting the series of portraits, finding great Americans who spoke the truth, and combining their images with their words as a way to channel my anger and grief. In the process, my respect and love for these people and their courage helped to transform that anger into hope and pride, and allowed me to draw strength from this community of truth tellers, finding in them the courage, honesty, tolerance, generosity, wisdom, and compassion that have made our country strong. The paintings will not be for sale. They will stay together as a group. The courage of these individuals needs to remain a part of a great tradition, a united effort in respect for the truth. These people form the well from which we must draw our future." It's a pleasure to introduce Robert Shetterly.
Thank you, Lily, and it's a great pleasure to be here. And where's Dana? Anyway, it was such a pleasure to hear him. I'd never heard him sing before. That was a real thrill. This is a treat for me to introduce Derek Jensen. I first heard about him when I started reading his essays in Hope magazine, which unfortunately no longer exists, several years ago. And then I read his books, and then it became clear to me that I needed to paint his portrait as part of the Americans Who Tell the Truth series. Excuse me for reading some of this, but I want to say it the way I meant to say it. I found his writing thrilling because it is both exhaustively researched and beautifully poetic. So comprehensive, full of economics and ethics, politics and history, psychology and philosophy, but more importantly, full of feeling. His writing explains to us, as no one else does, the mentality and emotions of the exploiters of nature and humanity, and then the mentality and emotions of the victims, whether among those victims are Indians and slaves, salmon and redwoods, honeybees, and human breast milk. He shows us that what we call Western civilization, in all its power and technology, its money and violence, is really a death wish that is coming closer and closer to being fulfilled. And then he goes on to show us how all of us are complicit. I found his writing thrilling because I knew I was hearing the truth. And that until we hear the truth, the full truth, all our attempts to change are absurd. You can't fix anything if you don't come to terms with the depth of the problem. The great folk singer and storyteller of the labor movement, Utah Phillips, likes to say, "The degree to which you resist injustice is the degree to which you are free." Derek Jensen is one of the freest people I know. But that is not the message, admiring Derek for his degree of resistance. His message is that we must shuck off the complacency and the politeness of our complicity, and each of us take responsibility for protecting the earth. Not admiration, but action is the message. That until we take responsibility for our actions, we are not of nature, but against nature, and we will reap what we sow. It is a great honor to introduce to you one of the Earth's great truth tellers, Derek Jensen. Thank you.
So can you hear me okay in the back? Is that all right? Move a little closer. How's that? Is that better? The reason, I think, given for the break after Dana's songs, was so people could go to the bathroom, but I think the real reason was so that I could stop crying. There's three of Dana's songs that always get to me. One of them is the one he ended with. Another is A Drop of Water. And oddly enough, another one is Cows with Guns. Anyway, so that whole effort of the 15 minutes off was just ruined by your introduction. I'm just up here. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. So I would like to thank all of you for coming. And I would also like to thank the Audubon Expedition Institute and Lily and Jasper, whose idea this was. Where are they? And where's Jasper? Okay. I would also like to thank Claire, whom I promised not to embarrass by asking her to stand up. And I would like to thank Rob for his extraordinary, extraordinary work. And Gary Lawless and Dana, obviously. Lear and Eric. I would like to thank Chloe and Meeting Brook, Tara Pass, Julie, W-E-R-U, Rick, Nick, and Caroline. And then also I would like to thank one of my heroes, who is Maureen Block. This, by the way, is how I know we're not going to have a revolution, because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. And I would also like to thank Nathan and Joyana and Brianna and Daniel and Jonathan. I'd also like to thank the people who are on the run and just say, fly low. I guess also, before we go any further, are there any, like, undercover FBI agents in here? It's worth a try. So if there are, then I have a message for you. Well, fuck you, that's one part of the message. And another part of the message is that when he was on trial for his life in Jerusalem, part of Adolf Eichmann's defense was that no one had ever told him that what he was doing is wrong. And I will not allow you that defense, and I want to say publicly that what you're doing is wrong, and I plan on seeing you held accountable someday. Okay, I don't know if you know this, but the movie Star Wars was not, the first draft of the movie Star Wars was quite a bit different than the later drafts and the version that finally made the screen. The original draft was written by environmentalists and was radically, radically different. And for those, is there anybody in here who doesn't know the plot of Star Wars? Oh, that's cool. That's great. That makes me so happy that there are a few people who actually don't know the movie. That's great. The movie came out when I was in high school, which is just the perfect time to have seen it. And I saw it, and I really liked it a lot. I mean, I wasn't one of those nerds who saw it 1,000 times or anything. I mean, I wasn't a nerd, and B, I was way too busy playing Dungeons & Dragons. Anyway, high school is a great time to see it. You know, it's like, oh my God, I was telling all my friends, the acting is so good. The plot, for those of you who don't know it, is that the Empire has built this thing called a Death Star, which is this huge machine that is capable of destroying entire planets. And of course, it's a wonderful metaphor for civilization, is, you know, a machine that is capable of destroying a planet. And the rebels are fighting back against the Empire, and they are able to figure out a way, they discover a way that they can actually destroy the Death Star. And so Luke Skywalker uses the Force to get past all the TIE fighters, and then he's able to, like, get real close, and he drops a proton torpedo into their thermal exhaust port. Which, I'm really not a nerd. And he blows up the whole Death Star. And that's pretty much the climax of the movie. But the environmentalist version is quite... Well, first off, the environmentalist version wasn't called Star Wars. The environmentalist version was called Star Nonviolent Civil Disobedience. And in this version, the rebels do not, of course, actually blow up the Death Star, but instead they use other tactics to slow the intergalactic march of Empire. For example, they set up a bunch of programs for people on the planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. And audience members also discover that there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of doomed planets. The purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that will get viewers to the edges of their seats, other groups of rebels file lawsuits against the Empire. They attempt to show that the environmental impact statement that Darth Vader was required to file failed to adequately support his decision that blowing up the planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors. And they'll leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. And then scribbled in the margins is a note from one of the screenwriters. For accuracy's sake, when we show examples of these letters, it's imperative that all letters to Mr. Vader be respectful and courteous, and they stress the need to find cooperative solutions to the differences between the rebels and the Empire. Under no circumstances should the letters be such that they would alienate or anger Mr. Vader. If the letters upset Mr. Vader, the rebels' letter campaign to the Grand Moff Tarkin will certainly fail as well. Now, we all know that that would be enough not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine and exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of the mainstream rebels, decide, in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to the eyes of even the most cold-hearted theatergoers, to stand on the planets about to be destroyed, link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs of that to Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few of the rebels sneak aboard the Death Star, and they lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment. And stirring debates are then held on screen among these rebels as to whether they should voluntarily surrender on approach of the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the very end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels are never able to come to consensus. Okay, once inside the Death Star, a splinter group breaks off from those about to lock themselves down, and they rush down these hallways, and somehow they avoid all the troopers, and they burn a couple of transporters, and they use chemicals to etch Galaxy Liberation Front on the walls of the Death Star. And then a few of the rebels actually break off from that group, and they sneak down all these hallways, and they get past all the troopers, and they finally actually make it to Darth Vader's headquarters, and they sneak up, he's all alone, and they sneak up behind him, and then they hit him with a vegan cream pie. The producers decided to cut that scene because it was too close to another movie that they were making at the same time that was called The Plot to Pie Hitler. Near the end of the movie, another debate is held among the rebels. And that was actually a problem that I had with this particular screenplay, is that there was a bit too much debate and not quite enough action. As the Death Star looms directly overhead, a few of the rebels advocate picking up weapons to fight back. And those rebels are generally shouted down by the pacifists, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. They state that the rebels who want to fight back are simply being co-opted by the need to control things. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. To change Darth Vader's heart, we must first change our own. We must, above all else, have compassion for Darth Vader and remember that he, too, was once a child. One writer put in the margins, excellent, that will be sure to moisten the cheeks of sensitive people everywhere. And he didn't mention whether those tears were of frustration. Finally, Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and a couple of robots show up, and they tell the others they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And the rest of the rebels are horrified. They say, voices firm behind the sobs, you can't blow up the Death Star. What about the janitors? So, in the exciting final scene of this version, a scuffle breaks out between Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and the two robots on one side, and the pacifists on the other. And the pacifists chase the four from the room and from the film, and they're never seen again, which really isn't very important because they're minor characters anyway. So anyway, what happens is the Death Star just looms closer and closer and closer. And then you see the planet, and you know the audience members are just chewing their fingernails, waiting to see whether the letters and petitions and lawsuits work their magic. And then you see the planet, then you see the Death Star, then you see the planet, and the Death Star. You see the lasers start to glow this hellish red, and then you see the planet again, and that's the environmentalist getting off before the planet explodes. And then the planet gets blown up. And then the final shot of the movie, which reveals what a complete triumph this was for the rebels, is a still showing an article from the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times, which devotes a full three sentences to the destruction of the planet. So it's like, yeah, we got some press. I gave a talk a couple years ago in Asheville, North Carolina, and afterwards... somebody during the Q&A, this one guy said, raised his hand, and he said, how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And I said, I don't know, I'll bite. How many? And he said, it wasn't a riddle. I'm like, that's not how this is supposed to work. And I, of course, didn't have an answer. And that night, I really fixated on, I went back to my hotel room, and I fixated on this question, which, frankly, says a lot more about my social life than I wanted to. And finally, an answer came to me, which is, how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is 10. One, to write the light bulb a letter requesting that it change. Four, to circulate online petitions. One, to file a lawsuit demanding that it change. One, to send the light bulb loving kindness, knowing that's the only way real change occurs. One, to accept the light bulb precisely the way it is, clear in the knowledge that to not accept another is to do great harm to oneself. One, to write a book about how and why the light bulb needs to change. And finally, one to smash the fucking light bulb, because we all know it's never going to change. So as a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss, and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed. And I've sat silent near empty streams that two generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of all those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use that word lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, so Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? What'll it take for you to call it an apocalypse? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so thick that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they'd capsize, so thick that horses were afraid to get in the water, so thick that you could hear them for miles before you see them? After a talk I did once, somebody came up and gave me a photograph of a river up in Alaska, And I just looked at the photograph, and I didn't see anything exciting about it at first. It was just a river with a yellow bank and a sort of grayish-brown bottom. And then you look at it more closely, and you see that that's not the bottom of the river. It's fish. The river is full of fish. And I showed the picture to my mom, and my mom said, yeah, give it another 10 or 15 years, and it'll be gone too. We need to bring this down now. Thanks, Mom. So what'll it take? Will it take the death of runs of salmon? Will it take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons here that were so large they darkened the sky for days at a time, flying? I'll wait. It's probably the fucking feds. So will it take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darkened the sky for days at a time? They were here, you know, flying 60 miles an hour, sounding like thunder. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of Eskimo curlews that are almost as big. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take the death of the cod. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. 90%. The response by the head of the National Marine Fisheries Services Division charged with overseeing the murder of the oceans, his response to that was, that's not a problem. We have to ask what level of decline is reasonable or sustainable. So in two sentences, he destroyed the words problem, decline, reasonable, and sustainable. I don't have his address, so I can't give it to you. So what'll it take? Will it take dioxin in every mother's breast milk? Will it take global warming? What'll it take, Derek, for you to finally call it an apocalypse? So Endgame really came about because I would ask people all over the country, do you believe that this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And that's pretty much the typical response is people would shake their heads no. A lot of people would laugh. One guy at one of my talks raised his hand. Everybody looked at him and said, oh, voluntary. No, of course not. And the point is that, of course, someday we will be living in a sane and sustainable way, or we won't be living at all. But the next question is, if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, and you care about the place you live, or you care about life at all, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is that we don't really know. And the reason that we don't know is because we don't really talk about it. And the reason that we don't really talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. And I'm going to bash hope later. That's one of my favorite things to do. And so this book really came about that if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And that's really what the book's about. And what I'd like to do for the rest of the talk is to go through the premises of the book, or go through a lot of them. And what I did with this book, which is different than any other book I've ever seen, is that I laid out my premises in italics at the beginning of the book. And one of the reasons I did that is because one of the first rules of propaganda is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. So, and I didn't want to do that. So an example of that is you hear some talking head on television say, so how can we make the U.S. economy grow? Good question. Well, premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell's we? And Hitler did the same thing. It was said of Hitler that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. So you can say, so what are we going to do about the Jewish problem? God, Adolf, good question. What are we going to do about it? Well, what he has slid by you is the notion that there is a Jewish problem you have to do something about. And that happens all the time. And so once again, I didn't want to do that. So I wanted to lay them out explicitly. So I'd like to start with the first premise here. And the first premise of the book is that civilization, industrial civilization, but all civilization, but especially industrial civilization, is not and can never be sustainable. Industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. A few years ago, I was riding in a car with my friend George Drafin, with whom I'd written a couple books, and we were stuck in traffic, actually, and I was just making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And George can sometimes be kind of a curmudgeon, and he was not in a very good mood. And he said, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we're going to be there again someday, and the only question is what's left of the world when we get there. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. In fact, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out. And, I mean, it doesn't matter what the resource is. If there's a finite amount of it and you're using it up, eventually it's gone. And so, I don't know, it might be a good idea to figure out. It's like okay, let's talk about, I don't know, let's take a random example, oil. You know, it might not be a bad idea if you have your entire economy based on oil to ask what's going to happen when you run out. Okay, but I'm going to take it a step further. And this is true, it doesn't matter what your resource is, whether it's oil, copper, iron, you know, if it's a finite resource, eventually you run out. But I would take it a step further, and I would say that any way of living that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. If every year there are fewer salmon return than the year before, eventually there will be none. If every year there are fewer passenger pigeons return than the year before, eventually there will be none. But in the meantime, they'll be really cheap in cities. And then I would actually take it a step further. And I would say, I mean, both of those are pretty obvious. We don't need to talk about those more, do we? I presume there aren't any, like, members of the Forest Service here, in which case we might have to go through it again. I would say that any way of living that's based on the use of resources won't last, because resources don't actually exist. Trees don't consider themselves timber resources, and salmon don't consider themselves fisheries resources. And this is a really important point for a couple reasons. One is that there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when I look at trees, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. Before we or they, before anybody can destroy the world, you first have to destroy it inside. You have to destroy it internally, and then you can destroy it in the real physical world. Artie Lang has this great book called The Politics of Experience, in which he talks about the fundamental part of this is, this is sort of Cliff Notes version, is that if you can understand someone's experience, you can understand their behavior. How someone experiences the world affects their behavior. And if you perceive the world, if when I look at trees, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at trees, I see trees, I'm going to treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. Same is true for fish. If when I look at fish, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at fish, I see fish, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular fish, I see this particular fish, I'll treat it differently still. Same is true for women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. That doesn't mean that, well, okay, let's step away from the women thing for a second and talk about trees and fish. That doesn't mean that I can't eat them. I was doing an interview in Spokane, Washington a few years ago, and the interviewer said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, well, what was the difference? He said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, well, what's the difference? I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. And I knew that that answer was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, and so I'm required by law to answer every question that's asked of me. And so then later that afternoon, I went out and I sat next to this tree that I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree answered right away, and what it said was, if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. So if I consume the flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon community. If I consume I had a big argument with this guy several years ago because he said that because I use toilet paper that I'm just as culpable for deforestation as the CEO of Plum Creek. And I told him that I thought that was kind of nonsense. And we said, go ask a tree. And I did go ask a tree, and the tree said, you're an animal, you consume things, get over it. And then it also said, yeah, you are culpable, but not because you use toilet paper. You're culpable for a far worse reason, because you consume the flesh of trees, but you don't take responsibility for the continuation of their community by stopping Plum Creek. And everybody understands this deal. You know, bears know it, mergansers know it. Mergansers know that if you eat every newt in a pond, there's not going to be any newts left for you. You have to take responsibility. By responsibility, I don't mean stewardship. I don't mean any sort of dominion thing. What I mean, responsibility comes from a root that means to give in return. It means to respond to once again, to give in return. And, you know, our discourse is so stupid. You know, we were taught all the time that, you know, natural selection consists of survival of the fittest, survival of the meanest, survival of the most exploitative. And, you know, this shows how stupid our discourse is. I can disprove that in one sentence if you give me a couple of semicolons. And that is, those creatures who have survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually making your surroundings better, by improving your habitat. Duh. So that's all nice, Derek, but what does this have to do with civilization? And I've been bashing civilization for probably, gosh, close on 15 years now, and I thought with this book I probably better finally define it. And civilization I define as a way of living characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. And that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? A city I define as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. So what this means is that the Talawa, on whose land I now live, were not civilized. They didn't live in cities. They lived in villages, camps. They didn't require the importation of resources. They ate salmon, clams, huckleberries, deer, elk, salal, salmon. And then usually through the winter, they would eat a lot of salmon. And they didn't require the importation of resources. They weren't civilized. So two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One of them is that your way of living can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, I know it's a nasty word, but let's go ahead and use it. If you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, and as your city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area. It can never be sustainable. Which means we could all become the best little green capitalists in the world. Doesn't fucking matter. Okay, the next thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence. Because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if the people in the next watershed over aren't going to trade you for this particular resource, if you require it, you're going to take it. Which means we could all become junior bodhisattvas, and the U.S. military would still have to be huge, because how else are they going to get access to the oil that they need to run the economy? Okay, so that's the first premise. Yeah, so that's the first premise right here, these two lines. So you brought sleeping bags, right? I think we only have like 18 premises. Second premise is that traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. We've seen that once or twice. The third premise, our way of living, industrial civilization, is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. I was doing a talk in Eugene a couple years ago, and in the Q&A, this one guy raised his hand, and he said, you know, I'm a nonviolent person. I don't commit any acts of violence, and I disagree that this is culture is based on violence, and I don't see any of it in my life. And it's important to the story, of course, that it's a man. The first thing I said to him is, okay, great, so where's your shirt made? And he looked, and his shirt's made in Bangladesh. And I said, we don't even need to talk about this, do we? I was like, no. I said, okay, next, I'm just curious, do you pay rent? And he said, yeah. I said, why? And he said, because I don't own. I said, no. What would happen if you didn't pay rent? And he's like, well, I guess I get evicted. I said, I don't know what that means. What would happen? He said, well, the sheriff would come to my house. And I said, okay, stop right there. What happens when the sheriff comes to your house? He knocks on the door, and you say, hey, I was just making dinner. Come on in. So he comes on in, and you cook him dinner. And then he sits down at the table, and you feed him dinner. And you don't poison him. And and then after dinner, you say, you know, it's really nice that you came over for a little while, but I don't really like your company all that much, so, and this is my home, so I think you should leave now. He said, well, I guess he'd take out a gun, and he would say, I'm here to evict you. Get out of your house. And I said, ah, so the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun is going to come and kick you out of your home. He said, I think I get it. Okay, let's try again. What happens if you're really hungry and you go to the grocery store and you start eating? You know, there's a lot of food there. And I said, what's going to happen to you? He said, well, I'm going to call the sheriff. He's going to come. Yeah, the guy's a real asshole, isn't he? The sheriff's going to come and take you away. So I said, okay, so the point is that you have to pay someone in order to have a place to live, and you have to pay someone to eat, to survive. And if you don't pay people for these things, corporations more likely, then somebody with a gun is going to come and do something bad to you. So one of the reasons that a lot of us can pretend that there isn't this violence in our lives is because, oh, it's like I was giving a talk in Massachusetts a couple years ago, and this one guy said, you know, we're living a lot more sustainably now than we were 100 years ago. And I said, what? And he said, look around. There are a lot more forests in Massachusetts now than there were 100 years ago. I said, yeah, that's because you get your wood from South America. And so part of the problem is that we don't see a lot of the violence because it's exported. And it's exported, of course, onto members of the natural world. And another reason that we don't see a lot of the violence is because we're so fully metabolized into the system that we go along. And if you step out of line even a little bit, the full force of the state will come down on you. I mean, I think that the Green Scare certainly teaches us that, among many other things. And, okay, I think that's enough on that one. And we'll go on to the fourth premise now, which is that this culture, and this is, I think, my favorite premise, this culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always invisible, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does occur, it's regarded with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And there's so many examples of this. One example is that my father, when I was a child, my father was extremely violent. And my brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. And he broke my sister's arm. And he raped my mother, my sister, and me. And the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time. Because not only had he fought back, but he had committed blasphemy by sending violence the wrong direction. That's one example, is that violence can only flow like that. Another example is, there's tons of bears where I live. And it's so, like, it's the cutest thing in the world. There's this one baby bear that's been coming around my mom's house. A mother and baby have been coming around. So, like, the baby discovered steps at my mom's house. He's, like, running up the steps, running down the steps, running up the steps, down the steps. And then, he discovered glass, too, because the cat was sitting just inside the door, the glass door, and he ran over to make her run away. And so he runs up to her and bonks his head right in the glass. And then, of course, he gets terrified and runs up a tree. And the cat the whole time is just sitting there looking at him. Anyway, so there's tons of bears around where I live. And I often walk in the forest at night without, you know, a lantern or anything. And everybody's like, oh, my God, aren't you afraid of bears? Aren't you afraid they're going to, like, kill you or something? And I know that there's one person dies in North America every other year because of bear attacks. And, I mean, on the other hand, there's about 46,000 Americans die every year in automobile accidents. So the truth is, instead of me being worried when I walk through the forest, like, you walk through a parking lot, it's like, oh, my God, you know, so the cars are all, or it's like, oh, my God, you know, here's a great example, is that I live 3 miles from the ocean, and I never get in. And you know why? Because that fucking movie Jaws, you know? I saw that at the same time as Star Wars, and and the acting was so good there, too. And you know, I still don't get in the fucking water because of that movie. You know, sharks. I know there was this movie a couple years ago called Spring Break Shark Attack. It's like, God, I wish there was that many sharks still left in the world. You know, sharks are so damn dangerous, but the ratio of shark attacks on humans to, the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is about 20 million to one. But when the violence goes down the hierarchy, it's unnoticed. When it goes up, then it's like, oh my God, somebody got attacked by a shark. Another example, cops. So I don't know if you know this, but every day in the United States, between 4 and 6 Americans die because they encounter police. Between 4 and 6. And that's through beatings, shootings, high-speed chases, and medical neglect in jails and prisons. And on the other hand, every time a cop dies, it's this big state funeral. You know, the bumper stickers, all gave some gave all. And, you know, all the cops are going down the road. And it's like, but you know what's the most dangerous civil service profession? Garbage collection. You know, but when was the last time you saw a big state funeral for garbage? And the reason is because they're hanging around these big trucks who want to kill them. You know, the trucks are like, we got you. And but you never see a big state funeral for a garbage collector. You never see a bumper sticker that says some gave all, gave some. And or when was the last time you saw a Tom Cruise movie where there's this intrepid garbage man is cleaning up the mean streets of L.A.? You know, it's like, doesn't happen because it doesn't valorize that violence. Okay, I want to try one more thing about this, which is, I mean, if you don't believe me about the cops, I have a little thought experiment to do here, which is the next time there's one of those WTO meeting or WTO protests or one of the, you know, anti-war protests or something, you know, all the cops are there in their full riot gear, take a baseball bat. Walk up to a cop and say, excuse me, Officer Friendly, I'm just doing an experiment, nothing personal, and then hit him. And then hit him a couple more times real fast. And then I'll talk to you in about 80 years. Oh, I have another one. Does anybody mind if I swear? So, yes? No? Well, make up your mind. Okay, so I would like, okay, I want to talk about the word fuck, because it's the most amazing word in the English language, because it's all a patriarchy condensed to 4 letters. Because the same word that means make love to means do great violence to. And that's really, really messed up. That's everything you need to know about painting. It's also really confusing, because then somebody can say to me, I'm going to fuck you. And it's like, I need more information. fuck is really interesting because not only is it all a patriarchy condensed, but it's also, I mean, it gets really, really interesting because if sex and violence get conflated like that, which is, you know, just twisted right there, and then you have violence can only flow down the hierarchy within this culture, that suddenly helped me understand homophobia, which I had never understood at all before that. I mean, the whole thing on homophobia is like, if you don't like homosexuals, you probably shouldn't date one. But the way I really started to understand this was with the whole Clinton don't ask, don't tell thing, where like you can be in the military, but you can be a homosexual in the military, but you can't talk about it, which I guess means you could still do it. But you, anyway, I need to say full disclosure before I go any further that I actually agree. I just have to say I agree that homosexuals should not be allowed in the military. I feel this very strongly, actually. But that probably doesn't mean as much as it could, because I also think that heterosexuals, asexuals, transgendered, bisexuals should not be allowed in the military either. But I had this idea the other day. What if, I think this is a great idea, what if they each had their own army? You know, it's like the bisexual brigade to the rescue or something? I don't know, maybe it might be kind of fun. Anyway, this spokesman, I finally understood homophobia. I never understood it at all. I finally understood it when this one spokesman, man, for the military, was saying that the reason you can't have homosexuals in the military, he said, can you imagine what would happen if a private had sex with a lieutenant? And I was thinking, yeah, sure, I can imagine that. But that wasn't really his point. And then he said it would destroy chain of command. I mean, the problem is not, and it wouldn't destroy chain of command because the lieutenant would fall so deeply in love with the private that he couldn't order him to his death. It would destroy chain of command because the fucking was going up the hierarchy. Notice he didn't say that if a lieutenant had sex with a private, because, oh, I need to go a different direction here for a second, which is that there's a great line by Catherine MacKinnon, man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. I love that. It's so great. And the objectification of women is so deep within this culture that even within the context of a loving heterosexual relationship, it's almost impossible for the man not to objectify the woman. So a man and a woman are making love, and the man says to the woman, I would like to be inside of you. You know what just happened? She's the object of the sentence. Okay, so now a man and a woman are making love, and the woman says to the man, I would like for you to be inside me. She's still the object of the sentence. Can't get around it. Well, you can, actually. The man could say to the woman, I would like for you to be around me. And the woman's like, can we speak English? So anyway, the reason I finally understood this is because when you conflate sex and violence, when violence can only flow downhill, that means that you have to have a fucker and a fuckee. And the fuckee has to be lower on the hierarchy than the fucker. And if the fuckee and the fucker are on the same level, then all the little tiny brains seize up. I think I've probably beaten that one to death enough. Okay, so wait. If I beat an idea to death, it's like the violence is... Okay, fifth premise of the book. The property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. Sixth premise of the book. Civilization is not redeemable. The culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. If we don't put a halt to it, civilization will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. I mean, if somebody would have brought down civilization 200 years ago, whatever that means, if someone brought it down 200 years ago, if Tecumseh would have won, then people in this area after the collapse could still eat passenger pigeons, even ignoring their own beautiful existence for their own sake. If somebody would have brought it down 100 years ago, people along the Columbia would still be able to eat salmon. I mean, just in terms of calories. I mean, there's going to be people sitting along the banks of the Columbia River 40 years from now. Well, they'd be glowing, for one thing, because of Hanford. But they'll be starving to death, and they'll be saying, I'm starving to death because you didn't remove the dams on the Columbia River that were used to manufacture electricity to smelt bauxite into aluminum for beer cans. God damn you. If somebody would have brought it down 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we wouldn't really have to worry. We wouldn't have to worry about dioxin in every mother's breast. We wouldn't have to worry about pesticides. If somebody would have brought it down 60 years ago, we wouldn't really have to worry very much about global warming. I mean, what, are people up 40 years from now, they're going to be saying, God, if somebody would have brought it down 40 years ago, we'd still have amphibians? Are they going to say, if somebody brought it down 40 years ago, we'd still have, you know, polar bears, we'd still have great apes, we'd still have, you know, name it. Oh, I just want to mention, too, that there are 2 million dams in the United States. There are 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall and 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. And people always say, God, Derek, you're so non-compromising. But, well, first off, I'll say that if we only took out one of those dams a day, the 7.5 feet tall ones or 6.5 feet tall ones, it would still take us 200 years to take them all out at one a day. And people always say, God, Derek, you don't want to compromise. But it's like, yeah, I'll compromise. Let's only take out five a day. It'll only take us 40 years. You know, the salmon don't have that long. The sturgeon don't have that long. Anyway, the eighth premise of the book. You know, another thing I was thinking, and this just occurred to me like 2 weeks ago. I mean, I've known this number about the dams for a long time. This just occurred to me about 2 weeks ago. That means, since all those dams have been made certainly in the last 200 years, that means that basically they were constructing a dam a day over 6.5 feet tall. That's really obsessive. This brings us to the eighth premise of the book. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I have just guaranteed I will never hold public office. Another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it's based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base. Okay, ninth premise. And ninth premise is actually pretty interesting because I found that there are a lot of things that I can bash and everybody's fine with it. You know, I can bash capitalism. It was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I can bash Christianity. It was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I can bash environmentalism. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can bash, you know, anti-civ people. That's all fine. I can bash, you know, I can bash corporations. Certainly, that's a great pastime. But there are a few things that if you start to bash them, then people really start to freak out. One of them, interestingly enough, I found that if I start to bash science, I can just feel the sphincters in the audience start to quiver. And another one is if I bash American Buddhism, it's all the pacifists start chasing me down the street. And another one, interestingly enough, is if you talk about population, sometimes people get really, really upset, and they accuse you of being anti-human for saying that someday the population will be much lower than it is now. And simply stating that observation means that you must hate people. And there's... Yeah, I'll get to that in a second. The ninth premise is that although there will clearly someday be far fewer humans than there are at present, there are many ways this reduction in population could occur. Some of these ways would be characterized by extreme violence and privation. Nuclear Armageddon, for example, would certainly reduce both population and consumption, yet would do so horrifically. The same would be true for a continuation of overshoot followed by crash. Oh, and I need to define some terms here first, which is that, we'll talk about that in a second. Other ways would be characterized by much less violence. And I need to say, you know, I say that I don't believe there's going to be a voluntary transformation, but every cell in my body wants for there to be a voluntary transformation. And it's the same with population. You know, every cell in my body wants for us to approach, and I'm going to talk about population more in a second, but every cell in my body wants for us to approach the whole question of there being more humans than the planet can support sort of reasonably and intelligently, and to just address the issue head on. I mean, if I ran for president, you know, my campaign would be based around, you know, vasectomies for everyone, for every male. In fact, when I was up in Canada recently, at a talk I did in Guelph, somebody shouted out, "What would be your campaign slogan?" And I didn't know, so I asked them to come up with one for me, and they came up with a great one, which is "a snip in every sack." So I'm ready to run. We'll talk about this in a second. So the point is that personally and collectively, we may be able to both reduce the amount and soften the character of violence that occurs during this ongoing and perhaps long-term shift, or we may not. But this much is certain. If we don't approach it actively, if we don't talk about our predicament and what we're going to do about it, the violence will almost undoubtedly be far more severe and the privation more extreme. And if we don't talk about this mess we're in. So having said all that, I need to say, by the way, that I don't think that population is a primary problem. I think that population is actually a tertiary problem. The reason it's secondary instead of primary is that... I need to back up and define terms here. That humans have exceeded carrying capacity. That's pretty fundamental, I think. And what carrying capacity is the capacity of any place to support a specific number of whatever species you're talking about forever. So you can have an island with a carrying capacity of 1,000 deer... could support 1,000 deer forever. And if 1,000 deer, if you exceed that carrying capacity, you can permanently reduce the carrying capacity. You overshoot it, and then you crash. So if you put 10,000 deer on that island that can support 1,000, they will eat too much of the vegetation, they'll denude the landscape, and the population will crash. And, you know, they always say that there is no such thing as a stupid question, but I actually got one recently. And I was doing a radio program in Humboldt County, one county south of where I live, and... there's this guy that whenever I'm on this program, he hates my work so much that he calls in, and I think he attacks me. I never can figure out what he's saying, though. And this time, he called up. He was just sputtering, and he said, "How dare you say that humans have conceded their capacity to care?" It's like, well, that may be the case, but that's an entirely different question. But the reason I don't think that, yes, there are more humans than the planet can support, but the reason that I don't think the population is primary is because numbers actually don't matter. If you had 100 gazillion people on the planet, it wouldn't matter if they didn't eat, shit, or stand anywhere. The important thing is how much damage you cause. And the reason this is really important is because when I think about overpopulation, the first thing I think of is a little brown baby in a third world nation. And when I think of overconsumption, the first thing I think of is an American and who's causing more problems. But the reason that population isn't even secondary, but it's a tertiary problem... Are there any demographers here? Any demographers? Good, I hate demographers. And the reason I hate demographers is because they often talk about something called the natural rate of population increase. And what that is, you know, if you have X number of humans and then, you know, time goes on, you know, it'll just exponentially grow. And it presumes that people breed like rabbits. But the truth is, I don't even think the rabbits breed like rabbits. I think that people make rational family planning decisions based on their personal and social circumstances. And if you have, for example, a culture that has, that somebody writes a book, and in this book they tell people to go forth and multiply, and this book is a really big bestseller, then that may influence people's reproductive choices. And likewise, if you have a culture that systematically does not see violence against the natural world as violence, that may affect their reproductive choices. On the other hand, the Talawa, on whose land I live, they lived there prior to contact for at least 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. If you believe the myths of the Talawa, then they lived there since the beginning of time. In either case, it's a really long time. Oh, and I have to tell you about this thing that happened. Okay, Christina's here. Is there anybody else who was at that talk I did in Princeton? Is there anybody else here who was there that night? Remember that guy in the audience this one guy said, you know, okay, so what, they were there for 12,500 years. That doesn't mean that they were living sustainably. She'll verify, I'm not lying. So I said, okay, give me a threshold. Would 20,000 years be enough? 30? 40? 60? 100? How about a million? A million years. A million years. Remember that? A million years would not be enough for him. Because he said we'd have to have quantitative data showing fuck knows what. That's neither here nor there. So if you have a culture that is in an intimate reciprocal relationship with their land base, when they start to have too many babies, they might throttle back on the babies. I probably shouldn't use throttle and babies in the same. I read somewhere that Native North Americans used about 350 different plants and herbs for contraceptives and abortifacts. And God, I mean, it was the women who made the decision to use them too. I said, what a bunch of fucking primitives. I got to tell this story. I love this story. Back at one point, anthropology was exclusively male, and they would go out and they would talk to indigenous people and say, how do you not have babies? And of course, they talked to the men because they're the only ones we're talking to. And they'd say, how is it that you can have sex and not have babies? And the men are like, well, you sing. And so the anthropologists were writing, you know, indigenous peoples don't know how babies are made, and or not made, as the case may be. And then later, when there were women who would join the field of anthropology, they would go and they would talk to the women of the female indigenous peoples, and they would say, you know, how do you not get pregnant? And then we're like, oh, you eat this certain root when you're 16, and then you're stale for 5 years, and blah, blah, blah. And the men are like, really? So the point is that the problem isn't even secondary, because the problem isn't consumption itself. The problem is the mindset that leads to this overconsumption and the culture that leads to the overconsumption. Okay, now having said all that, you know, back to this idea of someday there will be far fewer humans than there are at present. There was this one woman. I did two talks one day in Eugene, Oregon, and this one woman hated what I had to say so much that she came to both of the talks. And at the talk, she accused me of being a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin. And she also said, you were such a nice boy until you opened your mouth. I hit the trifecta that day, and I guess this was pre-George Bush, so if there would have been George Bush, she probably would have added him too. The reason is because I want to bring down civilization, and bringing down civilization will kill a lot of people. Therefore, I'm a mass murderer. And I have actually a bunch of responses to this. because actually I think it is a really, really, really important question. I didn't like how she phrased it, but it's an important question. And my first answer is that bringing down civilization, well, here's how I define bringing down civilization, as depriving the rich of their ability to steal from the poor and depriving the powerful of their ability to destroy the planet. That's a nice piece of philosophy, Derek, but the truth is bringing down civilization is going to kill a lot of people. Okay, my next answer is if you participate in this economic system, your hands are blood red already because the system is based on systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet. That's really nice, Derek, but if you bring down civilization, it's going to kill a lot of people. Okay, my next answer is that bringing down civilization is not a monolithic act. It's a billion different acts done by a billion different people. And if you include non-human people, it's, you know, a gazillion different people. And all of those different acts are going to have different moralities. And that doesn't mean that they won't cumulatively have some collective morality, because of course they will. But also we need to differentiate. For example, I don't care what your motivation is, it would be an atrocity to blow up a children's hospital. I don't care if you're an anarcho-primitivist or if you're a member of the U.S. military. You cannot construct a moral case for blowing up a children's hospital. Oh, yeah, you can, actually. If you're bringing freedom and democracy to the country, then. Which, by the way, I figured out how to listen to George Bush's speeches without going insane. Well, one is to turn the volume down. Another way, and this has to do with, remember the whole Freedom Fries thing? That's what gave me the clue. It's kind of like one of those jiu-jitsu things. You know, I took what they did and turned it back around. And that's that you just do word substitutions. And it's really fun. So every time he says the word freedom, substitute the word fascism. And every time he says the word democracy, substitute corporate control. It's a one-to-one correspondence. It's beautiful. So we are bringing freedom and democracy to Iraq. So yeah, you are actually. It's fun for the whole family. Just try it. I want to say something about the we thing, too. And it's like, we are bringing freedom. And it's like, I was at the post office a couple days ago, and the guy at the post office said, how much longer do you think before we bomb Iran? And I didn't get into it with him because he's at the post office. And anyway, but there's this friend of mine called me up a few months ago, and she said, so how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I said, we're in Iraq? I thought we're in Northern California. She says, Derek, okay, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? And I said, I got troops? Holy shit, will they do what I tell them? If I tell them to blow up the Grand Coulee Dam, will they do it? And she's like, Derek, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks. But I think that's a really important thing, because if we identify with them, we're not killing the planet. If we identify... We'll talk more about that later.